You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The tiny mole long has been a metaphor of revolutionary upheaval, an animal that long burrows underground, unseen, and then with a suddenness that startles, makes its appearance as it breaks through the Earth's crust. Certainly the Arab Spring burst into public consciousness with a startling suddenness. Only after did people begin to trace the underground pathways that were its prelude, from Tunisia to Egypt to Bahrain, Yemen, Libya, each with its distinctive features and yet with definite commonalities. Well, on July 14th, a handful of Israelis broke to the surface of their society's public life, cracking that crust of deceptive normalcy. The July 14th movement now has multiplied to hundreds of thousands. And we've reached Lisa Tarashansky in Tel Aviv, Israel. Leah is a journalist based in Israel-Palestine, reporting for the Real News Network. Leah also is director of an upcoming documentary titled Seven Deadly Myths. Welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio and the Red Eye program, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me, Mordecai.
Please give us a brief sketch of what happened in Tel Aviv on July 14th and then the subsequent spread and growth in numbers of the movement.
Sure. Well, it all actually started fairly spontaneously. There was a girl named Daphne Leaf, who is not a prominent activist or doesn't really have any roots to Israel's activist movement. And she just posted on her Facebook that, she's had enough of Israel's preposterous housing prices and the complete lack of opportunities for young people to find in affordable housing. And she said that she's going to set up a tent in protest on Rothschild Boulevard, which is one of the wealthiest and beautiful streets in Tel Aviv. And to her surprise, I think, and to all of our surprise, she was immediately joined by hundreds of tents. And by the end of the week, there were dozens of tent cities around the country, and now I don't even know how many tent cities exist. There's one in pretty much every city. That Saturday night, there was a huge demonstration that again surprised a lot of people here. People just poured out of their houses, and they sort of branded back then that this movement with the slogan "Am Dolesh Tzedek Chavrati," which in translation means "the people demand social justice." And there were some very radical chants there as well. The weekend after that, the numbers doubled. The weekend after that, we had the biggest demonstration in Israel's history. There were more than 300,000 people on the streets. And then the week after that, we had the terrorist attack that happened last Thursday, the result of which was, of course, the movement diminished on that weekend's protest. But tonight, we're going to see whether it's going to continue growing back up. And next Saturday, they're planning to organize a million-person march, will be Israel's first. So that's sort of a brief a history of that. And I also want to note that since this movement started, it has, as Amir Haas of Haaretz points out, redefined itself week after week with more people entering the movement. Now, if you walk down the main tent city in Rothschild Boulevard, there are people there protesting for everything from separation of religion from state to, stopping privatization of healthcare, everything. So it sort of became a political open platform for people who are advocating more social economic policies.
You make it sound as though everyone in Israel is participating in this, but are there sectors of the population which you would say are underrepresented or largely absent from this broadly spreading and also broadly focused movement?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, my immigration, the Russian immigration, there was a million Soviet Jews who came here in 1991, and now they're almost, they're more than a fifth of the population. They're mostly absent in this protest. The Ethiopian immigration of 1985 is mostly absent. And of course, the Israeli Palestinians are they're not absent, but they're not there in full force. mind you, in the last few weeks, they have definitely joined the movement and have been very welcomed by the sort of central Tel Aviv protest. And last weekend, for example, a representative from Taibe, which is a fairly oppressed city, in a Palestinian-Israeli city, he spoke at this protest and was welcomed. We've had joint Israeli-Palestinian protests in Haifa and Beersheba, so the Palestinian population of Israel is joining in. But I do want to say that, of course, not everyone is participating. It's still mostly young, and it's still mostly white, but they did a preliminary poll, and they found that 88% of Israelis support this protest.
Do you have, I'd like to get the Palestinian participation and so on a bit later, but do you have any thoughts coming yourself from a Russian Jewish community in Israel as to why that large proportion of Israeli society has decided up to this point not to be actively engaged?
Well, you know, there's actually been quite a bit written about that in the Russian press here in Israel about why they're not joining. And the Russian immigration, which almost exclusively watches the Russian media and reads the Russian press here, the press has been terrible on this protest. They almost refused to cover it, and they refused to really dig into the reasons why this is happening. So I think that the media is playing a very big part in having people not get involved. Also, the Russian community here in Israel is a very oppressed community. It's also a very poor community to a large extent. I think that this immigration has never really connected to Israeli society, and I think that they still feel marginalized. Now, having said that, last week there was a very political and very interesting conversation, a sort of open discussion that was spontaneously organized in the heart of the protest by Russian immigrant activists about why the Russian immigration is not joining. And you know, they talk a lot about poverty, they talk a lot about desperation. There's also the fact that we've come from the Soviet Union where, you know, you couldn't have a protest like this. To this day in Russia, you can't really protest. People don't really have an experience with protesting and organizing like that. I also think that, by and large, the feedback I hear from the Russian community here is that they're still waiting to see if this thing is going to lead to any concrete results before giving it any faith.
You mentioned the young woman in Tel Aviv who on July 14th took her tent and had no particular political engagement up to that time that you knew of. What about the leaders of the demonstration since it started? Is there anything particular about their backgrounds, both in terms of age, the cultural sector they may come from, but also in terms of any political engagement they may or may not have had?
Well, the people who were involved in the very beginning of this thing and I would have to say they're all young and they're all Ashkenazi Jews, which means that they're Jews from European origin but are third generation here or second generation here. But I think it's very important to note that this movement, which I think is what to me is the most inspiring about it, is it's completely decentralized and it doesn't have a leadership. So spontaneous protests happen on almost a daily basis. And in every community, people have been empowered to take charge of their own struggles. And there hasn't been any centralized organizing or centralized leadership that has been setting the rules. The only thing that is centralized is a website, an information website where people can contribute and add as they will. So in that way, it's been very interesting to see people who, both the people I talked about and people in every community that has been organizing, are usually people that have very little experience with organizing, but they're just determined because of the way things are going here and how terrible the situation is. Mind you, what is disappointing about it is that the people who started it and this definitely person have been very careful in saying from the very get-go that they want this movement to not be political, which here in Israel is a code word for not talking about the occupation. And they have released their list of demands, and, you know, even though they talk a lot about social justice and equality for all, they don't explicitly talk about the lack of equal rights for Palestinian Israeli citizens, and they don't touch the occupation at all. And when you look at the Israeli activist community, which week after week after week goes to the West Bank and works as body shields for Palestinians and people who work in solidarity with Palestinians, when you look at those demonstrations, which continue throughout this whole movement, they haven't really grown. You don't really see any new faces there. So because it started out explicitly calling itself non-political, it has more or less tried to remain that, mind you. Because it's uncentralized, decentralized, people have sort of created political spaces within it. And we've seen in the heart of the Rachel Boulevard tent city, there's now a couple of tents calling themselves 10-1948. And they talked specifically about the Nakba and the Palestinian-Israeli citizens here. There's also been tent cities set up in Palestinian-Israeli cities. And like I mentioned earlier, there have been Jewish and Palestinian joint protests throughout the country in the past weekends.
I can understand that slogans are things that might arise just by the people participating in a demonstration and so on, and vary from place to place and time to time. But still, their structures must be to decide where and when demonstrations going to take place, or when the government responds to some of the growth of the movement, decide what response they will have to that. So is that simply, you know, happens from time to time with different people that take those initiatives, or is there no structure at all?
I think from what I've seen, it's really been very fluid, to tell you the truth. It's been very, very spontaneous. Like, for example, the terror attack that happened here last Thursday that really sort of shook the country. It was the most violent attack we've had in years here. That 2 days later, there was a protest in Tel Aviv, and you know, the people who called the protest asked for it to be a silent march to sort of commemorate the people who have died. But within a minute, people started chanting, "Jews and Arabs refuse to be enemies," and the protest was sort of revived. The silence of it was sort of revived when people just refused to be silent and actually took advantage of the march to say, no, we won't let another war crush this protest, something that many people have been talking about for quite some time now, because the Israeli leadership has avoided dealing with the consequences of these massive protests. Many people have been predicting that the leadership is going to try to avoid dealing with it by entering into another war. And now that they have a terror attack, they have the reason to go into another war. And yet, people did not let that distract them from their movement.
This is, of course, a classical maneuver of Israeli governments, not just Netanyahu's, to create a sense that the whole nation must unite because it's under threat for its very existence, and these become beginnings of wars, whether in Lebanon and Gaza or elsewhere.
Or not even just in Israel. I mean, I think you can say the same thing about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, a point well taken. I'd certainly agree with that. But the Netanyahu government before this events of the terror attack inside Israel did respond to a certain degree with saying it was going to create some kind of commission. What was that response, and how was that received by the people who are active in the demonstrations?
Right. Well, he did set up a committee that's in charge of sort of analyzing the problems that people have been complaining about. That's sort of been its defined purpose. But the committee, which is headed by Professor Trachtenberg, has been mostly ignored by the movement. The movement has no faith, as far as I've seen, has no faith in this person and in this committee's ability to change things. I mean, the people on the streets of Tel Aviv and throughout the country are chanting revolution. And the more people ask what do you mean by revolution, the more I understand that you know, their point is not revolutionary, but they're trying to establish a complete drastic change, very drastic reforms to the very, very centralized and neoliberalized economy in Israel. And what has already happened is a sort of revolution in the way people think about the economy and the way things are going and their own power in changing things. So as far as the government's response, it's been very minimal. You know, for weeks, the protest was growing and growing and growing, and the prime minister said next to nothing. When there was a terror attack, he made a speech the very same day. So it's been a very conscious avoidance of the topic, and I think that he thought that this time around he could appoint another committee and people will find solace in that, and no one has so far expressed any real trust in this thing.
One of the slogans that was reported in one of the Real News Network shows that you prepared was Mubarak, Assad, Bibi Netanyahu, putting the Israeli prime minister in the same position as the dictators of Syria and of Egypt. Was that a fairly popular slogan?
Yeah, and every protest I've been to now, which I can't even count how many, at some point someone starts chanting something like Bibi, you should quit because the workers demand deserve more, or Bibi, you should quit. Israeli citizens are worth more. So at every protest, people have been demanding that the prime minister resign.
Let's return now. You made some observations on the Palestinian situation and the Palestinian involvement, or more a certain aloofness I took from your response. But clearly, the major victim of Israeli state policies and practices are the Palestinian people in terms of the ethnic cleansing, the seizure of lands, discrimination in law, etc. These aspects. In what way do you think reflection is taking place among the Jewish Israeli participants in these demonstrations that is taking them away from the idea that we don't want to deal with the occupation, or the code word, as you said, we don't want to make this political?
I think that one really interesting thing that I've noticed as I've been traveling through the peripheries and talking to people who have joined the struggle in very sort of small and peripheral cities where they really have nothing, people who you know, are living in shelters, or people who have a lot of children. And there's something interesting that happens that I've never heard on Israeli streets before, which is everywhere I go, people are talking about this rage, from this rage that, you know, the government only involved us in the process of security. They only involved us in wars as soldiers, as people who, no matter what, have to support whatever crazy security policy you come up with. And we've had enough. And I was in a region of Israel called Bikat Ono, where I was speaking to some people who literally have, you know, nothing to lose. And these are the people who volunteer for combat in the army. These are people who would typically be 100% for war. These are people who voted for Bibi Netanyahu in the first place and who supported the last war on Gaza. And they're saying, we've had enough of the government justifying everything to do with Israel's economy with security, because, you know, Israel spends more than three times per capita on security than what the U.S. does. So that's something that's very interesting, in the sense that people are saying that they believe that the government uses security as a veil not to deal with the domestic problems. And even though they're not tackling the occupation directly, if they even pursue that sort of concern to its logical extent, which is get the government to redirect funds, that would have an enormous effect on the occupation. And I think that another really exciting thing is that when this movement just started, 42 members of Parliament presented a letter to the Prime Minister saying that the solution to Israel's housing shortage is to build more in the settlements. And although this letter wasn't outright rejected by people from the movement, it was completely ignored. And what I hear again and again and again is, I don't care if Bibi builds 200 housing units in Ariel or in Jerusalem. I don't want housing in the territories. I don't want to live in the territories. I was born here in Haifa. I was born here in Akko. And I want affordable housing here. And that's something that that I hear a lot on the streets here. Is people just have had enough of the fact that Israel has basically, centralized and privatized the welfare state and moved it to the territories. So now, while for 20 years or 30 years, it has increased the privatization of everything from water to electricity inside Israel, in the West Bank, the settlers live under in a welfare state where everything, including public transportation, is subsidized. And people are saying now on the streets of Israel, people who are completely, in the past been depoliticized, saying, I don't want that to continue. I want a welfare state here.
The slogan of a welfare state was responded to a bit by Omar Barghouti, one of the Palestinian leaders of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, saying, well, it's like in South Africa under apartheid, if the white people were asking for better living conditions but ignored totally the situation of the vast majority of the country, the black population and the apartheid regime. It was a very bitter and strong comment. Do you think that's a major trend among Palestinians, that thinking, or the question is being explored more among the Palestinian community? Do you have any information on that?
Well, yes. I mean, I can't speak on behalf of Palestinians, but in my experience, I understand Omar Barghouti's criticism. I think it's valid. I think that for the millions of Palestinians who are living under occupation, they don't have the time to wait for the movement to come around and politicize itself, etc. The occupation, is influencing their everyday life every second of every day. But having said that, I think we need to put things into perspective, which is 2 months ago, the people talking about the government exploiting, security in order to not deal with domestic issues wouldn't happen here. We have, open discussions on the streets now, where spontaneous panels have organized themselves, hundreds of times now, talking about political issues, talking about the occupation, talking about settlements. That would have never happened before. A couple of weeks ago, there was a discussion about how to build a state after Zionism dissolves, and the people who showed up were people from every walk of life. That would be unimaginable here in Israel before this movement. So even though I do believe that it's not doing enough to take courageous steps towards addressing the very, prominent number one issue, which is the occupation, the issue that has divided Israelis, for 43 years, it's not doing enough. At the same time, this movement has definitely moved things in a direction that nobody here even thought would be possible, even just a month and a half ago. So I think that's a criticism that also doesn't really address the very complexity of Israeli society. It's a society that's extremely, extremely brainwashed from age zero to basically believe a certain set of beliefs about the enemy, and the Palestinians are part of that enemy, and we're taught to believe that they are within our country, they're in the territories, they want to kill us and all these other things, and this generation that has started this movement is the generation that grew up on suicide bombings and terrorist attacks, and yet they're not letting that stop them from having these discussions. At the same time, they're not taking these courageous steps in tackling the problem, the problems of with the occupation directly.
Well, many thanks, Leah, and appreciate particularly the contradictory aspects that you bring forward, and for taking time this evening in the midst of your own reporting work. And we'll certainly look forward to your ongoing reports on the Real News Network and the further developments of the July 14th movement.
Thank you so much for having me, Mordecai.
My guest has been Leah Tarachansky from Tel Aviv, Israel. Leah is a journalist based in Israel-Palestine, reporting for the Real News Network. You can access this excellent source of news commentary at therealnews.com.